Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today, December 23rd, 2021, is the 198th anniversary of the publication of the most famous American Christmas poem, "'Twas the Night Before Christmas," in 1823. The poem is generally attributed to Clement C. Moore, who claimed he wrote it to amuse his children. But adherents for a Major Henry Livingston Jr. claim he is the true author. However, there seems to be no proof Livingston, who wrote poetry, ever made claim to it, nor has any printing been found with his name attached to it. The Nightmare Before Christmas was a popular 1993 movie. Today's program is sort of about Christmas and the week after Christmas, as well as a personal projection of its progenitor. I begin with something I wrote and have inflicted upon this program a few times on occasion of this merry old season. Snow time for Santa. I saw the cops kick and club Santa Claus at the end of a downtown alley. I didn't have a video camera, so I didn't interfere. They gave him a final kick, a last rap on the head, which was covered by a red stocking cap, looked around the alley, and walked out into the busy street. I should have stayed out of the alley. I was lucky the cops hadn't seen me at the other end, a witness to their violence. I didn't want them kicking and clubbing me. But I had to answer a question that occurred to me when I first saw him knocked down by a club swipe. Why had cops beat up Santa Claus? It was Santa Claus, all right. He was fat and red-faced, crawling on his hands and knees in a red suit that had fluffy white fringes on the sleeves and cuffs when I got to him. I was scared the cops might come back and looked out from the alley down the street. A large crowd of Christmas shoppers thronged the sidewalks. I saw the cops haranguing a group of people in the street who were carrying "Don't Shop" signs. When I looked back, Santa Claus was collapsed against a building wall, holding his head and breathing heavily with a sort of rattle to it like something inside was loose. His eyes looked up at me in pain. "Why?" I asked, horrified. "Why'd they do this to you?" He didn't answer at first. I thought he might have passed out, or worse, but his eyes rapidly blinked and his lips opened and closed a number of times before noise finally came out, more a series of groans than words. "They said it was a warning," he gasped, leaning the side of his face against the wall. His white beard was ragged and matted with blood. Tufts seemed to be torn out. "What the hell kind of warning?" I almost shouted, furious that Santa Claus was a victim of police brutality. "They said they knew I was flying snow in from the North Pole." He looked at me in confused pain. "Why would they get so upset about snow?" The absurdity of his statement struck me like a snowball in the face. "Besides, why would I want to carry snow with me the one time of the year I can get away from it?" He took off his cap and tenderly felt the top of his head, where blood clotted in white hair. I was astounded. "The cops beat you up because they think you're smuggling cocaine into the country?" I said in disbelief. He stared at me wide-eyed. "It's called snow," I said. "A drug?" He seemed to forget his pain in his sudden indignation. He rose unsteadily to his feet against the wall and looked at me with rage in his eyes. "They accuse me of being a drug pusher? They accuse me of turning little kiddies into dope heads?" Illogical, but so was Santa Claus himself. A fat elf hardly anyone believed in anymore, not even children. I wouldn't have believed myself, except he didn't act like a store Santa Claus. Yet doubts assailed me. He looked like he was going to seed. Probably not enough believers anymore. Business suffering. Getting more difficult to pay for heat at the North Pole. I thought of many ways he could smuggle snow in with the toys he carried. Unscrew a doll's head, and there's enough crack cocaine inside to blow off little sister's head. His outrage cremated my doubts. He glared at me with the same kind of passionate fury that pictures of John Brown convey. I was confused, wishing I hadn't stopped. What was he doing here anyway? It wasn't Christmas yet. A little scouting trip, he sighed, reading my mind, and it seemed his rage dissipated in that little breath. His whole plump body shriveled like an old fruit. He started to hurt again. I've got to do it these days, he said in a sad voice. I can't keep up with the changes. My customer base is so much different than it used to be. He leaned heavily against the wall. His eyes looked me up and down as if appraising the kind of boy I had been. Did you ever believe in me? Well, sure, I said. Everybody does. Kids always think you're real. Another sort of pain, an older, familiar psychic hurt, redrew his face into a very old man's. They don't think I'm real anymore, he said. At least normal kids don't. Parents don't encourage them to believe in me anymore, or anything else except making money. Yeah, I said, trying to track the turn of talk. But don't you think you also encourage materialism by giving toys to kids? He shrugged. Maybe, but I don't think so. I know the arguments, and I think I don't do anything more than try to make kids happy for a few minutes once a year. Why don't you give them something besides toys? Simple things like what? He smiled grimly. You don't think I've thought about it? But they want more and bigger and state-of-the-art. That's what they ask for. High-tech stuff I don't know anything about and can't keep up with. The demand, even with the shrinking number of kids on my list. So you're getting ideas. Sort of, he said slowly. He held a silky handkerchief to his head as a compress. I'm also thinking of selling my name to a big toy outfit. Little Asian girls make those toys in sweatshops, I said sharply. Why not just smuggle dope? He looked at me in sad contempt. Easy for you to say. You're not a bygone icon who likes to eat well and doesn't like to be cold. I think I've got one last chance before everybody loses faith. He softened and said apologetically, Christmas shows people know how to make a profit out of their spiritual bonhomie. They like to give presents to each other and ring up a lot of sales for the stores they work in. So I figure I deserve a slice of the fruitcake after a century of toys for tots. I was about to give a sharp rebuke about the odious irony of Santa Claus slaying on the backs of children when I heard feet crunch into the alley. The cops were back. We told you to get out of town, fatso, one snarled, slapping his club against the wall. Santa Claus cringed. I ran. Just before I got out of the alley, I turned around and saw the cops kicking and clubbing Santa Claus, just like they did before. They probably finished him off this time. And that was Snowtime for Santa. And thanks to the San Francisco Examiner for the story about a Santa Claus who was beat up by police for singing Christmas carols outside a dinner for handicapped persons. And now, Kwanzaa, which might be considered the third and newest ornament of the Yule season, joining Christmas and Hanukkah. This year, 2021, is the 55th anniversary of Kwanzaa, which is the six-day commemoration of Christmas and New Year between the two from December 26th to New Year's Day, and celebrates African-American life, family, community, and culture since 1966. Kwanzaa is not a religious holiday, but a cultural one with an inherent spiritual quality, writes its founder, Dr. Maulana Karenga, chairman and professor of Black Studies at Long Beach, California State University, formerly known as Ron Karenga, a member of the Black Panthers, who created Kwanzaa following the Watts riot of 1965. Kwanzaa is from Swahili, meaning first fruit. The following is excerpted from the book, The Complete Kwanzaa, Celebrating Our Cultural Harvest, by Dorothy Winbush Riley. And a personal note, I was a Marine in Vietnam, the first Kwanzaa, in 1966. I learned about it from black guys I was in the war with, who themselves got the word from letters by families and friends stateside. Kwanzaa. Dr. Maulana Karenga, professor and chairman of Black Studies at California State University, Long Beach, created Kwanzaa in 1966. After the Watts riots in Los Angeles, Dr. Karenga searched for ways to bring African Americans together as a community. He founded US, a cultural organization, and started to research African first fruit harvest celebrations. Karenga combined aspects of several different harvest celebrations, such as those of the Ashanti and those of the Zulu, to form the basis of the week-long holiday. Kwanzaa 2021 will take place Sunday, December 26, 2021, through Saturday, January 1, 2022. The name Kwanzaa is derived from the phrase Matunda ya Kwanzaa, which means first fruits in Swahili. Each family celebrates Kwanzaa in its own way, but celebrations often include songs and dances, African drums, storytelling, poetry reading, and a large traditional meal. On each of the 7 nights, the family gathers, and a child lights one of the candles of the kinara, candle holder. Then one of the 7 principles is discussed. The 7 principles of Kwanzaa are unity, to strive for and maintain unity in the family, community, nation, and race. Self-determination, to define ourselves, name ourselves, create for ourselves, and speak for ourselves. Collective work and responsibility, to build and maintain our community together and make our brothers and sisters' problems our problems and to solve them together. Cooperative economics, to build and maintain our own stores, shops, and other businesses and to profit from them together. Purpose, to make our collective vocation the building and developing of our community in order to restore our people to their traditional greatness. Creativity, to do always as much as we can in the way we can in order to leave our community more beautiful and beneficial than we inherited it. Faith, to believe with all our heart in our people, our parents, our teachers, our leaders, and the righteousness and victory of our struggle. The 7 principles are a set of ideals created by Dr. Maulana Karenga. Each day of Kwanzaa emphasizes a different principle. Mazao, the crops, fruits, nuts, and vegetables, symbolizes work in the basis of the holiday. It represents the historical foundation for Kwanzaa, the gathering of the people that is patterned after African harvest festivals, in which joy, sharing, unity, and thanksgiving are the fruits of collective planning and work. Since the family is the basic social and economic center of every civilization, the celebration bonded family members, reaffirming their commitment and responsibility to each other. In Africa, the family may have included several generations of 2 or more nuclear families, as well as distant relatives. Makeka, placemat. The makeka, made from straw or cloth, comes directly from Africa and expresses history, culture, and tradition. It symbolizes the historical and traditional foundation for us to stand and build our lives, because today stands on our yesterdays, just as the other symbols stand on the makeka. In 1965, James Baldwin wrote, "For history is not merely something to be read, and it does not refer merely or even principally to the past. On the contrary, the great force of history comes from the facts that we carry it within us, are consciously controlled by it in many ways, and history is literally present in all that we do. It could scarcely be otherwise, since it is to history that we owe our frames of reference, our identities, and our aspirations." During Kwanzaa, we study, recall, and reflect on our history and the role we are to play as a legacy to the future. Vivunza, ear of corn. The stalk of corn represents fertility and symbolizes that through the reproduction of children, the future hopes of the family are brought to life. One ear is called Vibunzi, and two or more ears are called Mihindi. Each ear symbolizes a child in the family, and thus one ear is placed on the makeka for each child in the family. If there are no children in the home, two ears are still set on the makeka because each person is responsible for the children of the community. Mushumaha Saba, the seven candles. Candles are ceremonial objects with two primary purposes: to recreate symbolically the sun's power and to provide light. The celebration of fire through candle burning is not limited to one particular group or country. It occurs everywhere. Sawadi, gifts. When we celebrate on the seventh day of Kwanzaa, we give meaningful sawadi, gifts, to encourage growth and self-determination, achievement, and success. We exchange the gifts with members of our immediate family, especially the children, to promote or reward accomplishments and commitments kept, as well as with our guests. Handmade gifts are encouraged to promote self-determination, purpose, and creativity, and to avoid the chaos of shopping and conspicuous consumption during the December holiday season. And that was excerpted from the book, The Complete Kwanzaa, Celebrating Our Cultural Harvest, by Dorothy Wintbush Riley. And now, Born to be a Rebel, which I wrote and have read on this program at this season a couple of times. The claim is that a baby was born two millennia ago without benefit of sexual intercourse, which must have severely tried the faith of the father and perhaps greatly surprised the mother. No one is absolutely certain when the infant appeared in a stable among farm animals, his temporarily homeless parents, and Old Testament say, angels and other celestials. The baby was proclaimed the Son of God by three travelers known ever afterward as wise men, although in his lifetime none of the world's religions recognized him as blood or spiritual kin to any of the smorgasbord of deities of that period. He had no brothers or sisters who are known about. This is disputed, and he seems to have been encouraged in his own omnipotence, as only children often are. Not much is known about the child's early life until he reached 30. Like his father, or the earth person, who seems to have resignedly accepted his paternal role, he became a carpenter. Only one incident of his childhood is chronicled. He is said to have thrown a few money changers out of a temple, which betrays an early example of his essential naivete. He emerged from obscurity when he was 30, and until his death 3 years later, he roamed around preaching radicalism, sedition, and revolution. He was unusually popular among the impoverished and discontented, attracting followers of homeless and unemployed, mentally unstable and physically disabled, sexually and politically deviant, and other assorted pariahs. He eventually came to the attention of authorities, who were greatly concerned about his disruptive effect upon the lower classes. So were upper-level members of the clergy. A paid informer from his inner circle, called apostles, betrayed him, and he was executed after an inconclusive trial. His place in history and myth is principally as a religious figure. However, a significant number of scholars challenge that he was the son of any but a humble carpenter. They claim he was a political activist, specifically a labor organizer, in an era when workers had absolutely no political or personal rights or liberties. These revisionists refute that he was executed for religious preaching, as even contemporary times show, religious radicals, TV preachers, and cult founders can be tolerated within a society, while labor agitators are frequently imprisoned or murdered. His execution is often cited as evidence of this theory. He was crucified on a cross, a usual method for dispatching criminals and enemies of the state, replaced in later periods by the gibbet, guillotine, electric chair, and hanging rope. However, nails were driven into his hands and feet instead of suspending him by the customary rope bindings. The specific use of nails is proof enough, the revisionists insist, that he was arrested and executed for his brazen attempts to organize carpenters and others of the working class into what would later be known as a labor union, and that he had no intention of founding a religion. Some of his later followers, though adherent of him as Son of God, have acknowledged that he antagonized the law and order establishment of his day. They admit, in the words of a few, that he attacked the very roots of his society, and that he was a problem to his mother and to his entire generation. He was the most radical leader who ever lived, a 20th century disciple has written. Although the revolutionary nature of his preaching caused his execution, his later proselytes adapted the status quo to their creed, which ultimately became his most effective instrument of perpetuation. By structuring a theology on the claim that he was the Son of God, his successors enjoyed an advantage most temporal systems lack and religions benefit from. They did not have to deliver on their promises. Indeed, for two millennia, they have kept their flocks docile with extravagant suggestions of everlasting life beyond the desiccation of the flesh, which surpasses anything secular organizations can offer. And the sweetest part of it is they don't have to prove any of it. The first generation of his disciples eagerly martyred themselves, incidentally providing immensely popular food for circus animals and great entertainment for Roman fans. The farther west succeeding generations moved, the center of their expanding religion, the increasingly lighter his skin and hair in evocation of his image, and his radical ardor was, even with a beard favored primarily by male barbarians, softened to a benign, implicitly feminine expression. He is called the Prince of Peace, yet in his name his followers have warred incessantly against peoples of differing beliefs. Heresy, the bombastic justification for ritual murder of non-believers, and against each other as sects rise and claim themselves his only disciples. In his name, genocide was waged against the original inhabitants of the Americas, and Europe was made a cemetery in the name of Reformation, 17 centuries after his death. In the most grotesque excess of theology, a bizarre, vengeful sect that confused him with grim, ancient gods he displaced almost succeeded in exterminating the religion of his parents, which had refused to accept him as a long-awaited Messiah 2,000 years earlier. His presence might be useful again, but not in the scenario of Armageddon or Rapture, some of his more fervent disciples yearned for, nor would it help if he, or she, posed as a Messiah, Buddha, or Guru. Humanity, as it has so often before, could use a few good prophets, revolutionaries armed with visions instead of weapons and hatreds. Unfortunately, false prophets emerge in unsettled periods who create great mischief and misery, whose violent and vengeful ambitions obscure quantum visions of universal suffrage and prosperity. Perhaps it is time to re-examine his real message to humanity. instead of a Son of God predestined to die to defer humanity's responsibility for its sins of greed, rapacity, and butchery, we have an ordinary carpenter who, for reasons that have been lost due to his deification, felt compelled to fight the slavery and injustices of his era and attempted to raise up the poor and disenfranchised into a powerful force of revolution. If that is what he was, then he did not die to save our souls. He lived to make us free and was put to death for that heresy. That was Born to be a Rebel, which I wrote and have presented on this program a few times. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk is engineer of this program. I wrote a letter to the Daily Astorian one Christmas season, a quarter of a century ago, in the final decade of the last millennium. Quote, "Just the other night, I walked up a hill above the Columbia River and Astoria's waterfront. As I panted up steep sidewalks past old Victorian-era homes, most well taken care of and brightly lighted these holiday nights by complex strings of colored electric lights, I glimpsed a lighted Christmas conifer in an apartment window just under the pointed eave of a three-story roof. The lights were all colored red, a few blinking in a pyramidal climb to the top of the tree. I stopped and stared at the simplicity, and I felt that Charles Dickens stood looking at it with me, his arm around my shoulder. The best Christmas exchange this Yule is the same as last, the mutual preservation of life and health. Celebrate Christmas cybernetically through electronic miracles with family and friends. Stay alive and healthy for the upcoming New Year, and Merry Christmas."